Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Let me welcome you to LSE, to the Development Studies Institute, and to LSE AIDS. I'm Tony Barnett, and I am chairing this meeting. Can I ask you, please, to do the necessary with any mobile phone and other communications equipment you may have about your person, and turn it off. Otherwise, you'll cause grave embarrassment. And having said that, I have to, of course, turn my own off. Otherwise, I'm enormously embarrassed. This is one of a series of public lectures on aspects of HIV/AIDS, which is funded by the UK Department for International Development, to whom we are extremely thankful. There will be another lecture in this series in a few weeks' time, and that will be publicised on the LSE website, and several more during the rest of the year. I have to tell you that Hilary Benn, the Secretary of State for International Development, who was originally advertised as a co-performer this evening, had to cancel. Tonight, I have enormous honour to introduce our speaker, Dr. Peter Piot. Indeed, he should probably be called Baron Piot because he was ennobled by the Belgian monarch in 1995. Peter is Executive Director of UNAIDS, the United Nations Joint Programme on AIDS, and he is an Under-Secretary General of the United Nations. However, I can tell you that that did not stop him almost being refused entry to an extremely exclusive London club today, where we had lunch. When he turned up, you will note he has a tie on. This man learns fast. He turned up at this austere place with a roll neck sweater, and the doorman looked and went. And unfortunately, our honoured guest had to change into an available shirt, which was fortunately around, and a strange tie, and sat uncomfortably in a shirt two sizes too small for him throughout lunch. So despite his eminence, in London, he can almost be refused entrance. Peter's background is as a physicist, a medical doctor, and a professor of microbiology at the University of Antwerp. He's also an enthusiastic gardener, he tells me, although I'm not sure how he gets time to do any gardening at all, given his travel schedule, and I guess there's a lot of weeds in your garden.
No.
Not at all.
In what he himself describes as his cowboy years, Dr. Piot learned about infectious diseases and their effects when he worked at the field level, travelling and working widely in Zaire and other parts of Africa, often under extremely dangerous conditions to himself in terms of exposure to infection. It was during this period, in 1976, that he was a co-discoverer of the Ebola virus. And you can learn more about those years and Peter's considerable bravery in Laurie Garrett's book, The Coming Plague. Tonight, Peter speaks in his capacity as head of UNAIDS, where he is charged with mobilizing efforts globally to confront one of the greatest disease events in human history. So it gives me enormous pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Dr. Peter Piot.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you for inviting me here. I'm really very grateful for all of you for spending an hour or so with me. And it's good to see so many old friends and new friends and pioneers in the fight against AIDS in this room. And I'm happy to see also a lot of people I've never seen before. So that, I'd like particularly to commend Suma Chakrabarty and Robin Gona of the FID for your leadership in not just for this lecture series, I know that, but also for what you are trying to achieve, particularly in this crucial year of 2005 in moving the AIDS agenda to its next level, I would say. And tonight I hope to honor LSE's great tradition of debate by raising for your scrutiny what, in my opinion, is by far the most pivotal issue concerning the AIDS epidemic. And this is whether AIDS is such an exceptional threat to humanity that it must command an exceptional response now and into the foreseeable future. And let me restate this bluntly and in detail. Is the AIDS pandemic so exceptional a threat that it is in a league altogether different to other infectious diseases or causes of ill health? Is the pandemic so exceptional a threat that its control should not be just one of many Millennium Development Goals, but rather an overarching priority, a prerequisite to achieving the MDGs? Is the threat so exceptional that it demands a binding first call on the attention of political leaders as well as on finances? So exceptional that it demands that we undertake fundamental changes on many fronts if we are to succeed. Ladies and gentlemen, AIDS is exceptional, and the response to AIDS needs to be equally exceptional. And I know that this is a very risky assertion. I'm not the first one to make such claims for any issue. Modern history is littered with examples of meritorious global issues for which this sweeping claim was made but not sustained, inevitably to the detriment of that cause. So I really have thought long and hard before publicly voicing this claim for the exceptionality of AIDS. But for the past year or so, I've been certain that this case is beyond refutation. And tonight I want to lay out the case fully that AIDS is an exceptional threat, as well as reflect on what I mean by an exceptional response. And before taking up these issues, I must emphasize that I'm not arguing that AIDS should be the solitary top priority for policymakers and budgets. Rather, my argument is that the AIDS pandemic needs to be recognized to be one of the most serious threats to our prospects for progress and stability, on a par with such extraordinary threats as nuclear weaponry or climate change. And consequently, that the pandemic warrants a response as exceptional as that accorded to the control of nuclear weaponry or climate change. Let me turn to the first of the issues that I've set out. What are the grounds for claiming that the AIDS pandemic is exceptional as a global crisis and threat? As actually also recognized in the report of the high-level panel on threats to global security, and that gave its report to Kofi Annan just a few months ago, and that dealt for the first time not only with the classic war and peace definition of security, but also included a major chapter on AIDS as a new threat to global security. This pandemic is exceptional because there is no plateau in sight. Exceptional because of the severity and longevity of the impact of AIDS, and exceptional because of the special challenges it poses to effective public action. A first and crucial way in which the AIDS pandemic is exceptional is that an epidemic equilibrium or plateau is nowhere in sight. Not globally, not at the level of epidemics in most countries, and not over the long term. The pandemic has broken with the general pattern of diseases and natural disasters, which usually create their own brutal equilibrium, eventually enabling societies to cope. We've seen it from the Black Plague in the Middle Ages to the Spanish flu. AIDS so far appears to be doing the opposite. Take Botswana, Swaziland, and other parts of Southern Africa where the HIV prevalence rate among adults now is around 40% or higher than 40%. Just think what that would mean for London, that you have just in London millions of people living with HIV and millions of orphans. At the same time, the epidemic is globalizing increasingly rapidly, from West Africa to Eastern Europe, from China and India to Central America and the Caribbean. And in country after country, the tipping point is being reached, that ominous point which varies between countries, after which AIDS no longer remains concentrated in so-called hotspots, but becomes a generalized explosion across the entire population. This has already happened in several countries in West Africa now, including in Nigeria, with its population of around 140 million. And within the next decade, the Asia-Pacific region, with a population five times that of sub-Saharan Africa, could easily become the next epicenter of the epidemic, with every small increase in HIV prevalence translating into tens of millions of people infected. So think about this. A mere disease, a medical curiosity at the beginning, a disease that it's not even easily contagious, a disease that was a circumscribed epidemic only 25 years ago, has morphed into a pandemic of cumulatively over 65 million people since the beginning of this epidemic. And this pandemic will continue to expand for decades. The long gestation period that characterizes AIDS is only one reason why this epidemic will continue to expand. It will not be expanding so fast and without an apparent plateau were it not for the two other factors that I have already mentioned: the exceptionally damaging impact of AIDS and the exceptional challenges it poses to timely and effective public action. And let me turn to these now. The impact of AIDS is exceptional in that it is uniquely far-reaching, beyond generations. It sets off a chain, actually, of devastation, a toppling of dominoes that you can see in societies. And Tony, you were actually the first to put together irrefutable evidence of this in a project that you led, I think, for DFID in 89, and which resulted in the landmark book, AIDS in Africa, Its Present and Future Impact. This is now, 16 years ago. And the process at work here, as you know, is that AIDS primarily kills adults, primarily young adults, who are not only the motors that drive economic growth, but just as vital, the motors that nourish succeeding generations. AIDS truly affect every society, three generations: adults, grandparents, and the children. And to understand the outcome, consider the fact that in sub-Saharan Africa's worst affected nations, AIDS is steadily wiping out the labor force. How can governments function? Public services operate? Agriculture and industry thrive? And law enforcement and militaries maintain security when they are being stripped of able-bodied and skilled women and men? How can any of the Millennium Development Goals be met, whether child survival or education or poverty reduction? These are some of the questions we have been trying to address in a joint project with Shell on the long-term scenarios for AIDS in Africa, which we will launch about a month from now. I'm happy to see Alan Dietrich from Shell here in the room. It's important to realize that this is not some future nightmare that is hypothetical. No, it has been unfolding for some years, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa. Let's recall that the Southern African food crisis 2002 and 2003 resulted not just from drought or floods in the case of Mozambique, but from the progressive weakening of agriculture because of AIDS. And by next year, without far higher treatment rates for HIV, 11 sub-Saharan African countries will have lost more than every 10th person in their labor force to AIDS. And by 2010, 5 will have lost more than every 5th person in their labor force. I must emphasize that in such severely affected countries, the long-term result over another 2 generations or so could literally be the unraveling of economic and social development. And perhaps we need to discover, or to use a new term in the future, and that is one of undeveloping countries. Countries like Mozambique, like Botswana, that have done such a great job in good management, governance, economic development, and because of AIDS, may undevelop. The key factor here would be the cumulative weakening from generation to generation of human and social capital, the severing of connections between one generation and another. And again, this is already underway. This is not hypothetical. Within the next 5 years, every sixth child in the worst affected African countries will be an orphan, largely because of AIDS. 1 out of 6. Can we even grasp the implications for the development prospects of these countries, let alone respond meaningfully? How can such a loss of human and social capital be replaced? And what would it cost? How long would it take, even if undertaken with the greatest commitment of resources and will? Apart from chronic armed conflicts, such as we're seeing in Democratic Republic of the Congo, or earlier in Afghanistan or Angola, there's arguably no other cause today of such utter economic and social regress. One last but crucial point about the exceptional nature of the impact of AIDS. While it is in sub-Saharan Africa that we can see the terrible and lasting consequences of full-scale AIDS epidemics, the impact is severe on particular aspects of development, even where HIV prevalence is relatively low. And one of the most direct impacts is on poverty. So a recent study of studies, set of studies that we undertook with the Asian Development Bank in Asia, showed that AIDS will slow the rate of poverty reduction in Cambodia by 60% every year between 2003 and 2015, and in Thailand by 38% annually. And AIDS magnifies ongoing development crises in middle-income countries. For example, in Russia, AIDS is accelerating the demographic crisis. And studies that we did with the World Bank and UNFPA estimate that by 2025, 20 years from now, AIDS will increase by nearly half the decline otherwise expected in Russia's population. As you know, Russia is going through a severe demographic decline, which is one of its biggest problems for even for economic development. I will now move to highlighting a final way in which AIDS is exceptional as a threat. And there is no escaping the fact that the sensitive issues that are at the heart of the pandemic, sex, drugs, gender inequality, commercial sex, homosexuality, have proved to be an enormous barrier to effective public action. And that is action by both government and civil society. If HIV were not mainly transmitted through sex and needles used to inject drugs, but through some innocuous means, food or whatever, we would probably not be experiencing the epidemic of today. Political leaders would have faced up the gravity of the threat. Think of mad cow disease. Think of other crises, that food crisis that Europe has dealt with in recent years. Leaders would have spoken up, allocated resources, led the response. But prejudice and discomfort about HIV transmitted are unfortunately still so widespread that they continue to silence many leaders who, for that kind of things, may not have more sophisticated feelings and ideas than anybody you meet in a pub. And this is also affecting civil society leaders, church leaders, including even, I'm sorry to say, leaders of women's movements in some countries. It also keeps many of them from acting, too often because of the inexcusable judgment that people at risk or those already infected are morally inferior. This kind of exceptionality might seem to be of minor importance, of a soft type of element, compared to the other 2 points. But I personally feel that this is a serious error to underestimate the implications of HIV-associated stigma and the attitudinal barriers to public action on AIDS. Amartya Sen has long pointed out that public action is typically more easily forthcoming on such visible things as famines, natural disasters or outbreaks of highly contagious diseases, than on chronic or silent problems such as poverty. With AIDS, we are faced with not just a chronic or silent problem, but one where the barriers to prompt and effective action are immeasurably magnified by taboo, denial, prejudice, shame, and so on. And in country after country, you can see the consequences of this exceptional aspect of AIDS. Action comes too late, it doesn't protect the vulnerable or the poor, resources are allocated for those who are the least at risk, and the epidemic takes hold and expands. So I believe that these three sets of facts show irrefutably why the AIDS pandemic is exceptional as a current crisis and long-term threat. And yet I find that too many influential and knowledgeable people still don't recognize this. Some have done it a long time ago. Far-sighted thinkers like the late Stephen Jay Gould, who declared nearly 20 years ago that this pandemic is, and I quote, potentially the greatest natural tragedy in human history, an issue that may rank with nuclear weaponry as the greatest danger of our time. Such visionary, far-sighted thinkers have remained in a minority, despite the evidence that has confirmed Gould's worst fears of about 20 years ago. And I find that the majority of the people who shape global policies continue to view the AIDS epidemic as just another health threat, as something on par with TB and malaria as one of many Millennium Development Goals. For instance, at the World Economic Forum in Davos, I was a few weeks ago, it still doesn't figure under the global issues theme, but under health issues. Just as telling, the really excellent commitment to Global Development Index that the Center for Global Development publishes, and where it ranks the rich nations on how their actions on several fronts help or hinder poor countries, AIDS is still absent from that list. Even though the index has always factored in damage to the global environment, rightly so. And given this audience, I can't help but point out that many economists, political scientists, and public policy experts have dropped the ball too and have not really taken on this issue. And we need you. We need you really to tackle and think through these very difficult issues. Often we have continued to regard AIDS as a matter for health specialists rather than a crisis of such gravity that they should, or we also should, chip in with skills and influence. And I hope the establishment here of LSE AIDS, Tony, that this will go a long way towards correcting this neglect. The upshot of this widespread failure to recognize that AIDS is an exceptional crisis and threat is that the response to the pandemic is not made commensurate to the challenges. And so the epidemic escalates even while it erodes our capacities to check it. So in other words, not only is this AIDS going to progress as an epidemic, and while at the same time our capacity to deal with it in the worst affected countries is getting worse and is weakened. So what would amount to an exceptional response to the AIDS pandemic, given the point at which it is today, and given what we know of its likely long-term trajectory? I once thought that the answer was that we all had to do much more and much better. And I now believe I was wrong. Routine development or humanitarian approaches and financing are not sufficient as a response to pandemic. Of course, we need to do more, we need to do better, but we also need to do it differently. The response to AIDS needs to be driven by a level of political will and public concern that we also see, for example, how to deal with the threats posed by nuclear weaponry, as I said, including binding global treaties, closely monitored regimes, not me.
It's being done.
Okay, thank you. There's some problem with the... What was this?
Strange sounds are coming out of the microphone.
And deserves really the constant attention of world leaders, which I'm happy to see that is on the agenda of the G8 and the EU presidency of the UK. I see three key elements to turn around this epidemic. Each of them essential, none of them sufficient by itself. And on each of these fronts, an exceptional effort is needed. A first element, a foundational element, is real leadership and real activism in each country. And this leadership and activism must come from across the board, from politics, from civil society, from business, the media, churches, just name it. This is not an extraordinary demand because it's precisely what AIDS has elicited, though not on the scale and intensity called for. The history of the pandemic shows that in virtually every country that has succeeded in curbing its epidemic, or shows the promise of doing so, it has been because of the interplay between activism and responsible governance. This is as true of the UK and the US as of Brazil and Thailand. And this is true also of the international response, whether in terms of action on HIV treatment access, human rights, or financing the response. And in practice, this activism has not belonged to any one particular sector of society. It has come foremost from people living with HIV, in many cases, or by their relatives and survivors. Think of South Africa's Treatment Action Campaign and Zaki Ahmed, Uganda's Tasso and Lorraine Kaliba, ACT UP in the US and the Terence Higgins Trust here in the UK. And it has come from communities threatened by HIV. Think of the sex workers' collectives, Sonagachi and Sangli in India, and of Thailand's Drug Users Network. It has also come from numerous human rights activists, members of the political elite, journalists, feminists, and leaders in business. And I believe it is a new form of civil society movement that we may see emerging for other issues as well. Activism is vitally important to the response because it's the most potent force to get political leaders to overcome their unwillingness to act promptly on AIDS. A point that I've already emphasized. And as so often in history, top leadership is a mix of personal vision and responding to pressure from civil society or others. And let's face the fact, the role of governments in initiating, leading, and coordinating a response to AIDS is paramount. We can't do without. We've never seen a single nation reverse its epidemic without a strong leadership of a president or prime minister who looks at the numbers and evidence, admits the danger, and delivers the right kind of response. No partnership, so fashionable these days, no NGO, no business can replace this role. Only governments have the mandate to direct the national policy, national resources, and national leadership. That is the foundation of a response to the epidemic at a scale that will actually make a difference. And if we had seen real leadership in Africa a decade ago, matched by equally real leadership from donor countries, the continent would not have had over 25 million people living with HIV today. Nor would India and South Africa each have upwards of 5 million people infected. So our first need is for exceptional activism and responsible governance. The will for public action that results must then be focused on expanding people's rights and fundamental freedoms. And I know that many hard-nosed economists, political scientists, and public health specialists are notoriously resistant to discussions of these matters, freedom, human rights, inequality. But not only has, again, Amartya Sen eased my task by his brilliant explanation of why these matters are central to development, but these matters are also of special relevance to AIDS. This is so, again, because the major drivers of this epidemic universally are the failure to fulfill people's rights, discrimination or the curbing of the fundamental freedoms of particular groups, and inequality of all kinds, notably gender inequality. A second element of an exceptional response, of course, is adequate financing. Though funding for the response in low and middle income countries has soared from under $300 million in 1996, when UNAIDS was created, to $6.1 billion last year, this is just half the amount required for 2005. And if we coast out the needs for a stronger response for 2007, this would be between $14 and $18 billion. Contrast, based on current commitments, we expect $10 billion will be available for that year. $7 billion from international donors, we hope $3 billion from domestic resources. So though this shortfall remains enormous, I'm now godly optimistic that it may be closed, this gap. Low and middle income countries are making far greater domestic investments on AIDS, something that we in the West seem to forget, and we think that anything that happens in a developing country comes out of the pockets of taxpayers in Europe or North America. Since the Global Fund's inception 3 years ago, it has approved over $3 billion in grants for AIDS, with more than 60% earmarked for Africa. And the World Bank's multi-country AIDS program for Africa has now already disbursed over $1 billion. And since President Bush's path-breaking commitment in 2003 to provide $15 billion over 5 years for the response to AIDS, there has been real evidence that several donor governments are finally becoming serious about addressing the resource constraints. And Prime Minister Tony Blair's decision last July, to contribute £1.5 billion over the next 3 years to the response to AIDS is a stellar example of that. The most promising recent development is, of course, the proposal to secure adequate, long-term, stable funding for international development, including AIDS, through an international finance facility. And 2005 will really be a crucial year for anything that is to do with development, and that includes also AIDS, not only from the funding perspective, but also from to use the funds in a much better way, and so that they respond to the needs of countries. As I've emphasized, this pandemic will be with us for generations. So the financing has to be such that it allows exceptional action on the crisis front, as I call it, treatment, expanding treatment to antiretroviral, with antiretrovirals, and support for orphans, as well as exceptional action on longer-term solutions. In the first place, strengthened HIV prevention and the development of vaccines and microbicides. I do want to put in perspective this recent evidence of deeper commitment by the leaders of donor governments, however laudable and important. The African countries worst affected by AIDS would gain far more in financial resources from the cancellation of debts, from the ending of rich world agriculture subsidies and trade barriers, and from truly affordable prices for pharmaceuticals. Isn't it hypocrisy, and worse, when rich countries dole out aid while their remaining policies serve to undermine the capacity of poorer countries to respond to the pandemic? I can't but agree with the conclusions of the most recent report on the Commitment to Development Index, and I quote, "No wealthy country lives up to its potential to help poor countries." In terms of an exceptional response to AIDS, rich countries will only have lived up to their responsibility when they agree to reform the gross inequities of prevailing trade and financial rules. That's why it's so important that when you deal with AIDS, you have a whole of government strategy, just as the one that the government here launched in July, not just for development or health or whatever. For too many years, billions of dollars annually have gone to servicing debts that African countries could have put to investing in AIDS response, education, or other critical development fronts. But because of AIDS, exceptions were made on access to generic medicines in the World Trade Organization rounds in Doha and Cancun, another example how the exceptionality of AIDS is infiltrating everywhere, but they don't go far enough and are overly complex. And an exceptional response to AIDS demands a new compact between the pharmaceutical industry and the world's poor. A new just compact involves two elements. The first one is to give the pharmaceutical industry patent monopoly and good profits in rich countries. And this is essential because we need innovation, we need new drugs, and particularly new antiretroviral drugs will be desperately needed all the time. Probably every 3-4 years we need another drug because people will develop resistance. So incentives for innovation are absolutely crucial. But the second part of the compact is to allow poor countries to legally manufacture and sell generic medicines. And at the same time, the pharmaceutical industry should further the competition by selling antiretrovirals to poor countries at cost-plus prices. This is slowly getting part of the picture, and a few years ago would have been unthinkable. One final point on the financial side. Public expenditure ceilings, such as those set in medium-term expenditure frameworks, restrict the levels of investments across all sectors needed to mount an exceptional AIDS response. Now, how can the goal of financing an exceptional response to AIDS be balanced with fiscal and economic discipline and good fiscal and economic sense? This is no longer an academic issue. Now that millions of pounds are flowing into developing and transition countries. And I witnessed it in Uganda a few weeks ago. It must be possible to find a solution, just as solutions have been found for post-conflict or post-disaster situations. And I was flying back from Uganda, where I was with Suma Chakrabarty and colleagues from Norway and the World Bank. I was thinking, if European countries in 1945 and after it would have had medium-term expenditure frameworks and budget ceilings, the Marshall Plan would have been impossible. And it would have taken another extra 10 years or so to get out of the destruction of World War II. Shouldn't we really give it a chance and some out-of-the-box thinking? Increased spending on AIDS must be recognized to be a capital investment, not just an expenditure item only, because these investments are going to restocking and protecting human capital. So why can't they be considered to be temporary off budget? Now, this is really high-risk behavior from my part, being just a doctor and saying these things at LSE. But I hope that many of the economists here in the room will take up the challenge of seeing how this can be done and how these competing demands can be reconciled. And finally, there's the need for exceptional implementation, for on-the-ground action. Making the money work for people on the ground is our top priority today with these billions that are starting to flow. Money raised and political will garner have to be translated into bringing services to the people. On this front too, we need a complete break with past implementation practices. And to have real results, implementation should focus now on three goals. The first one must be a renewed commitment to HIV prevention. We must not turn our backs on prevention of HIV because it's difficult and sensitive. And we have to confront sex and drugs. We know very well what needs to be done in prevention. We need what works. We know what works. If we don't act and break the cycle of new infections, we will not be able to even sustain the cost of treatment. Let's not forget that. Crucially, HIV prevention efforts have also to fit the realities of women's lives. We must promote real access to the female condom. We must speed up development of microbicides. Girls need to be assured of education. And governments must enforce laws to make domestic abuse illegal and to treat rape as a crime that is punished. A second goal should be to find ways to reverse the depletion of human and institutional capacity in countries that are the most affected by this epidemic. We must aggressively protect capacity in countries where the AIDS epidemic has not advanced so far. Suma and I saw this on a visit to Malawi last year. We saw the terrible dimensions of the human resource crisis. It's worse in the health sector because of AIDS, poor salaries, and not the least the active recruitment of nurses by the UK and other countries in this part of the world, and South Africa as well. The starting point is to preserve existing capacity. Let's start with that before we talk about adding capacity. In other words, to keep people alive. Give them a good salary, but keep them alive. And this is why providing antiretroviral therapy is so critical. In the hard-hit countries, nothing else, I believe, will so directly or quickly arrest the plunge in capacity as this single measure, not only by decreasing mortality, but also by boosting morale of the staff. Antiretroviral therapy has reduced mortality by 80% in Brazil. I don't know what other capacity-building measure that we have in our repertoire in development can show such a return. So a core part of an exceptional response is to ensure the success of 3x5, the campaign that we launched with WHO to provide 3 million people with antiretroviral therapy and treatment by the end of this year. And while we press ahead with this campaign, it's imperative that we plan for the longer effort, because increasing numbers of people will be on treatment for life. We treat people because we believe that this will be 30, 40 years. Resistance to the cheap drugs is unavoidable, so we must plan now how we are going to deal with that. But in the same breath, let me emphasize that preserving capacity is just as much about prevention, about keeping uninfected people uninfected. And where I see where this has been the best internalized is in big corporations, particularly in Southern Africa, where you have workplace programs like in Anglo-American that combine both prevention and treatment, whereas many governments now are just focusing on treatment. And we'll have a price to pay for that. I must also emphasize that building capacity is not just about training nurses and doctors. It's foremost about supporting communities, particularly people living with HIV. And this would raise capacity, empower people living with HIV, and help break the stigma around AIDS. This fact was freshly imprinted on my mind last month in Kenya and Uganda. Community efforts from the Kenya Women's Network, from TASO, the AIDS support organization, and Our Lady of Africa Mbuya Parish in Kampala, were all working successfully with people living with HIV, not only to deliver antiretroviral medication, but also on HIV prevention, support to orphans, and keep the girls in school. There can be no substitute for building capacity of this kind, and it's probably far cheaper than some of the more classic capacity building activities, because it's the most empowering and it's the most sustainable. Helping countries build and sustain human and institutional capacities, of course, has always been one of the biggest challenges in development. It's nothing new here. But this challenge has taken on extraordinary urgency in the age of AIDS. And we need all of you here this evening, present here, to use your brains and help us to find a solution for this challenge or solutions. And one last goal for implementation, made increasingly imperative because of the major influx of funding for AIDS, is to harmonize our efforts, making sure that we all move into the same direction and not into different direction. And waste and inefficiency and high transaction costs from duplicate efforts by donors, be they government donors or NGOs, are major obstacles to the response against AIDS. For example, in several countries in Africa and Asia, last year there were more than 50 donor AIDS planning missions just in one country. In other words, one a week. And it's just for AIDS. There are donor missions for other things as well, of course. Hundreds. With each visit, understaffed agencies push aside pressing work, to take donors on site visits. People are polite. Countries must often satisfy donor conditions that are not a part of their national aid strategy. And scarce staff time is absorbed filling out paperwork rather than saving lives. So when we discuss absorptive capacity, sometimes we have to ask ourselves the question, who absorbs whose capacity? This problem, of course, has long been true of development work in every sector. But on the AIDS front, I'm happy to report some progress. And last year, UNAIDS with the UK and the US governments brokered a global agreement with all donors on supporting country-level action on AIDS so that donors and host countries can work together to shape a more effective and coordinated response. And this agreement, known as the Three Ones, means that each country has one national AIDS strategy that integrates the work of all partners under national ownership and leadership. One national AIDS coordination authority to manage that strategy across all sectors and involve civil society, and one country-level monitoring evaluation system to measure and determine what's working. This roadmap for harmonization and joint accountability now needs to be made a reality on the ground. And the next step forward in this process is a meeting that will be held here in London in March, March 9th, and we're calling to making the money work. Bring together, again, civil society, actors, and ministers of international development and health from various countries at the invitation of Hillary Benn and myself. So let me conclude now. I hope I have convinced you that only an exceptional response will suffice to reverse this unprecedented epidemic. This is also a crisis, I'd like to remind you, that will continue for some generations. And so a basic choice is for me only whether we will act exceptionally right now or later. If we don't do it now, the problem will just grow and grow, and then at some point there will be a tipping point where people are convinced that it is exceptional. But many more millions will have died. We cannot plead ignorance. 20 years ago, yes. Today, we know the facts. So we have only one option, and that is to live up to our responsibility now. Wherever we are, whoever we are, because fighting this epidemic will require the brightest and the most entrepreneurial of the brains of people and of professionals of our time. And so I'm counting on you. Thank you.
Peter. Thank you very much.
Well, this is LSE, and therefore we have lots of time for discussion and debate, and I'd like to invite questions now. Would you please make sure that you speak very clearly and preface your remarks by saying who you are, and if you have some kind of significant institutional affiliation, you might want to mention that as well. We'll just wait a second or two until those who are rushing off, no doubt, to exciting dinner dates and theatres, or to finish their essays.
Yeah, don't forget your tie.
And don't forget your tie. And I see that there's somebody up there who already wishes to ask a question. You, sir, please.
Hi, Harley Calvon, the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Thank you for your excellent presentation. You mentioned that finding global treaties and monitored regimes, similar to those used to counter the threat of nuclear proliferation, could be used to fight HIV. Do you think that the security and intelligence community that typically handle such threats take a leading role in fighting the disease as well?
Do you want to have a series of questions?
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, we'll take a few questions at a time. Please. Ben, can you speak up, Ben?
Yeah.
Oh, there's a microphone. There we are.
Ben Ramalingam of the ADI. The ABC's Development Institute in London. We're a think tank focusing on humanitarian and development issues. I'd like to ask Peter Pio, to what extent does he think HIV/AIDS policy is based on evidence? Our findings from a recent report suggest that it's not really based on evidence, and there are large gaps, particularly when it comes to research into policy and implementation on the ground in developing countries.
Hello, my name's Emily Bell. I was working in the HIV/AIDS department in WHO. I'm not anymore, but...
Is it significant?
Not for any bad reason, I'm just not working there. It's about testing for HIV/AIDS. One of the big problems seems to be that in high prevalence countries, less than 1 in 10 people know their HIV status. So even in countries where they're beginning to roll out treatment, people simply aren't coming forward to be tested. And you're talking about AIDS as an exceptional illness, and it seems that in some instances, the exceptionalism is some part of the problem. Like the voluntary counselling and testing model still remains in many countries. People have to go forward for an HIV test. They're not offered one routinely. I know that UNAIDS and WHO announced in the Bangkok AIDS conference that they were advocating for routine testing. And I'm just wondering what sort of steps are being taken. I know Botswana's introduced routine testing. What steps are being taken to push this forward in other high prevalence countries so that people know their status?
Thank you. This lady here, and then this lady here, and then we'll have a break for responses, and then we'll move on.
My name is Jessica Horn. I guess I could call myself an activist linked to sexual reproductive rights activists in Africa. My question is about the implementation and the two points that you raised, one about prevention and one about donor harmonization. And it's quite an earnest question, but I want to know what you can do with a funder like the United States and Bush's policies around that, where they're promoting abstinence only and they don't like condoms. And how you harmonize with that approach when you know that the issue is about sex, it's about discussing openly sex and sexuality and having and providing those services for young people, for people that, again, the Bush administration is not interested in doing, men who have sex with men, etc. So I'm just wondering how you harmonize in that context.
Thank you. And this lady here, the last question in this batch. Lady behind you there.
Hi, my name's Marika Tavernier. I'm a student at Imperial College, and I also work for Grazia Smith Klein. You mentioned that you think that there should be a new compact between pharmaceutical companies and developing countries, and which would involve two elements, giving patent monopoly and good profits to pharmaceutical companies, whilst at the same time allowing developing countries to produce legal generics. How do you think that this could actually be achieved in practice, considering the enormous costs that are involved in developing medicines by pharmaceutical companies?
Right, let's have some responses to that batch, and then we'll move on to some more questions. And you might want to ask questions of the audience as well.
Yes. all very, very good, important questions, and each of them deserves actually a speech and some studies. First on the security community and the security issues. In January 2000, the UN Security Council, under the chair of the then Vice President of the US, Al Gore, debated for the first time AIDS. And it was because of Richard Holbrooke, who was then the US ambassador to the United Nations in New York, that this happened, because he bulldozed this through his colleagues, who basically were all against discussing AIDS as a security threat. It was totally new. It actually was the first time that a, let's call it a social or a soft issue, was debated in the Security Council. And for me, this was... one of my goals when I got into this job was to get AIDS in the Security Council. I thought a lot, you know, what in the UN system, the UN, what is taken seriously? My conclusion was the Security Council, more or less, and that's about it, in terms of a body that is really making decisions about life and death. And since then, there have been four debates about AIDS in the Security Council. And whereas in the first one, the Russian and Chinese ambassador were not there, the last one, they made probably the most forceful intervention, although perhaps because it was the first time. There is quite a big change internationally in terms of recognizing AIDS as a threat to global security. And as I mentioned, the high-level panel that the Secretary General put together to advise him on reform of the Security Council, but also how the world community should deal with new threats of security, gives a prominent place to AIDS. I've always been a bit cautious. On the one, we have a unit in UNAIDS, an office for AIDS and humanitarian and security issues. What do? We, on the one hand, we make sure that peacekeeping troops are not spreading HIV, that they're bringing peace. This is based on a resolution 1308 that the Security Council voted and that asked us to do that. And so I had to establish this unit. And we are working then also with the uniformed services in many countries, so try to work upstream. In many countries, the military now have a far more progressive HIV prevention program than in civil society. Because once you convince the general or whoever is in charge, you know, the commander, then there are relatively few moral or moralistic and other considerations. Just it's an order and here we go. And that has had already a big impact. It has been a port of entry for HIV and AIDS in several countries, where in some of them the military have something to say. We have but I've been cautious in the sense that we shouldn't turn every development problem in a security issue either. We've got to find the right balance. And I think as far as AIDS is concerned, we are, I think at the moment, we are reaching that good balance, where indeed it is considered as a threat to global security. It has classic security implications. I mean, some armies in southern Africa have like 40-50% of all the military are infected. I mean, that has immediate security implications, or the police force and so on. So it is, the security world is actually getting on board, and what we are lacking now is some more work on evidence, what is the link between AIDS and security and so on, some conceptual and intellectual work, and we're actually working with LSE on that, or we're starting to. If we can get the contract in order, then it will happen soon. Secondly, is what we are doing based on evidence. I have this strong view that in public policy and in our actions, we should not use the word evidence-based. If we can have evidence-based, the better, but it should be evidence-informed. Because at the end of the day, what we need is the evidence, the scientific evidence, mixed with what values, what priorities do we put in the society? What are we... It should be a mix of both. That's one point. Secondly, we have evidence. The first and most important evidence is that it is possible to reduce the number of new infections in a poor country, in a poor society. That is the most important evidence that we have. Uganda has shown that. Thailand has shown that. Brazil has shown that. Dominican Republic. We're seeing it now in every single East African capital. The number of new infections is going down. It's always in young people. So that is evidence that is purely empirical evidence, which is the best one, not what comes out of computer models. The second evidence is that is more limited, and that is that it's possible in poor resource settings to provide antiretroviral therapy, at least for a few years. The long term, we don't know yet. The jury is still out. I'm not saying it's not possible, but we haven't got the evidence.
there is definitely a need for more evidence development, let's say, when we work with orphans on the whole impact mitigation. That there is, well, besides what you've been doing and a few other people in the world, there's incredibly little been done. That's where I think the evidence work would be. And then the rest is we're moving more into, let's call it monitoring and evaluation, and then steering the programs. That's what I feel is the priority. In terms of testing, I agree with you that I believe that the one of the biggest obstacles now for rolling out treatment, besides all the systemic issues, is that people don't know whether they're infected. That is also actually helping HIV prevention. And before there was access to antiretroviral therapy, there was really no incentive to know whether you're infected or not. And that's why I strongly always advised against massive testing. It just was very bad use of public and private resources. The former Soviet Union, Iraq, some of the Gulf states, but particularly this former Soviet Union, performed hundreds of millions of tests until, fortunately, the public sector ran out of money and couldn't afford the tests anymore. But the net result is what? 1 million people living with HIV in Russia at the moment. So they put all their money in testing and basically nothing, and that will have to do with public education, dealing with sexuality, and in the case of Russia and other countries, with injecting drug use and the epidemic of heroin. But with antiretroviral therapy becoming available, the situation has completely changed, even if it remains a rare commodity for most people in most developing countries. There is an incentive here. And we've seen it in Botswana, for example, that when it got known that treatment is available for people with AIDS, that the demand for testing has gone up logarithmically. And so indeed we have changed, which says that whenever there are opportunities in, particularly with people who go for whatever reason to a health facility, that this HIV test should be offered, but only there where there is some reasonable chance that there is a treatment available. So that will be, what steps are we doing to implement it? Well, it's one of the biggest issues is that we have to make sure that physicians are willing to take that, to face that, because the problem is if when you test is that some people are positive, and then somebody has to tell them that you're positive. And I've done that myself hundreds of times, and it's one of the worst things that you can imagine to have to do that. And that takes time. And when you are a physician or a nurse seeing hundreds of people a day and clients, how do you organize that? You can't just give a piece of paper and say, madam, here, you're HIV positive and go now to the clinic to get your treatment or so. That requires a whole setup, and that is what we've got to work on. And that's where I believe that people who are already living with HIV, and in countries where many of them don't have a job, with some minimal stipend, and but particularly good management, I think they could be very important counselors and helping to get that organized. On prevention, and how can we harmonize with the United States? It was a question somewhere out there. You mentioned abstinence, but there are other issues also. This US Congress, which puts very strict accountability and accounting constraints on what American taxpayers' money can do, that it whether it can be put in a basket or not. So that's another consideration, which is of a different nature than the ideological or moral consideration. I think it's possible because it's actually happening. And that is why it was one of the, I would say, the great achievements of the 3-1s agreement, that the United States agreed to it and has actually actively promoted it. Internally, it's not perfect. And what are some of the aspects is that, one, if donor A doesn't want to fund certain things, donor B can do that. But that can only happen in a rational way if the harmonization happens at the country level. If the donors are there to support the efforts, the goals of the nations of these societies, otherwise you can't do that. So it's important to have global agreements, and I spend enough of my time to believe in it, but it's really at the end of the day on the ground that it will have to happen. And this is why it's so important, and I know this is not l'air du temps, this is not really always very popular, but that you need a state that is capable to handle that. Why is this such a problem, particularly in Africa, and not so much in Asia or in Latin America, this whole urbanization business and donors imposing their views? Because don't try to do that in China or in India or in South Africa or in Brazil. It's not that, you know, these are not dictatorships, all of them, but it's because there is a strong public service, focal civil society, and you come under our terms. When you are extremely poor, when the system is weak, the state is weak, it's difficult, more difficult to say no to competing demands. But I think that the discussion we need to have is really at that level as much as the at the global level. And what is happening, of course, is that when there is one donor that is very dominant and comes with a loaded agenda in terms of substance, and I fully agree with you that you can't deal with AIDS without dealing with sex. It's just not possible. That may incite some governments to change their course as well. So money sets policy and not the other way around. I know that very well from being in UNAIDS, where we are supposed to set policy and coordinate, but without controlling the money. So I know the problem. Then the last thing on the new compact. That new compact is actually starting to materialize. This was the deal that I proposed to pharmaceutical companies when I negotiated a reduction in the price of antiretrovirals by over 90%. I said, Rack, you have the choice to become like tobacco companies, or to lose what is your most precious asset, and that is intellectual property protection. Without intellectual property protection, there's not going to be a pharmaceutical industry of any that's meaningful. Just as the same thing is true for the IT sector. And so the deal is really that if the rich countries provide the incentives for innovation, because what you said is right, I mean, it cost up to $200 to $250 million to develop one new drug. And as I said, there is hardly any health condition that requires so much innovation as AIDS. We will need really every 3 years or 4 years a new antiretroviral drug, because the previous one will have become obsolete because people, virus develop resistance. If nobody will invest, or very few people will invest in this kind of huge sums if there is no return on the investment. So we've got to preserve that. But the question is, who should pay for these investments? And should the poor pay as much as the rich? No, I mean at the global level. In a global environment. And that's what we're trying to do. It's another, in essence, it's a subsidy to people in developing countries. And I know our social security and health services are under heavy financial pressure in all donor countries, but I think that should come into the equation, that we maintain innovation while at the same time having some fairer global distribution of access to these goods. What's more difficult is actually local production of high-quality medicines in small countries. India has an old know-how, and the generic pharmaceutical companies in India are making huge profits now. It's a bonanza for them. And China is now beefing up its quality assurance in manufacturing and so on. But Zambia or Rwanda or Burundi and so on, this will be much more difficult to produce high quality medicines. That's why it was so important to have this, for those who are familiar with it, to have an exception of flexibility for Article 6 of the TRIPS agreements, the International Intellectual Property Protection Agreement. Thank you.
There was a question up there. A lady at the back, James Buxell there. So please, there was a lady there. No, all right, please, you ma'am. Yes, you. That's it.
Anna Thomas from Christian Aid.
Where are you?
Up there.
Here.
Okay. Hey.
Do you think that global leaders are starting to treat AIDS as a threat on a par with nuclear weapons or climate change? And if not, what single action or event or happening would do most to convince them?
There was a question, the lady at the front. Oh, James, okay. As you have the microphone.
Okay, somebody passed it to me. I didn't grab it. Dr. Piat, James Putzel from with LSE AIDS and the Crisis States Research Center here at the school. And I want to congratulate you on your leadership of the UN AIDS, which I think has been extremely important and strategic. I wanted to ask you two questions. One of the things that's coming out of some of the research that I've been involved with and others have done as well have been problems associated with a one-size-fits-all template for the organization of the response at the national level. Then I speak of the National AIDS councils or commissions that have been set up in various countries. And I think here we do raise the question about whether this has been promoted based on sound evidence and sound evaluation of the experiences of the NAC. And perhaps part of the exceptional response that you speak of, which I endorse wholly, needs to break from what is in some ways a World Bank imposed condition for a one size fits all template in order to release money for the MAP. But I think UNAIDS has played a big role in this, and I wonder if enough work has been done to evaluate the differences. And not least because as we want to preserve capacity, we also want to preserve the capacity we find in governments and build on it. And there's some evidence that the way NACs have been set up at times has actually cut in and weakened governments' abilities to play their full role. The second question, I just want to push you a little further on the ARVs that you've addressed and acknowledged a problem. This is a great hope now, as you say, in rolling out programs across the developing world. But when we look at the evolution of the cocktails of ARV treatments in our own, in London or in other places where we're treating AIDS. We see mutations and changes and resistances developing so quickly. And in the complex nexuses of the epidemic in Africa and other parts of the developing world, are we really rising to the challenge of being able to develop the kind of response with these drugs that's going to be necessary? And if not, could we be, you know, courting disaster right now? And do we not need to give this much more effort?
Alan Pamba from studying public health at the School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. I just wanted to find out, do you think we are going to be able to achieve the 3x5 initiative now that we are in the year 2005? And if not, what do you think have been the main stumbling blocks towards achieving that?
And there's a lady at the back there, gentleman here, gentleman at the back there.
Yes, Julia Ferrari from the Radar Image Project in South Africa. Julia Ferrari, collaborating with the Radar Image Project in South Africa. This question is actually connected to the previous one regarding the one size size-fits-all approach. And to this respect, like looking at the issue from a different angle, I hope this hasn't been covered in the lecture, I should actually probably say before, because unfortunately the theater was so full that I couldn't get in, which is a very positive thing in terms of like so many people being interested in the topic. But I was wondering whether there is any sort of explicit initiative to actually value and collect and share the knowledge that has been accumulated at the micro level, like from the numerous projects, more or less successful, that have been carried out throughout the years. Sort of something that is actually publicly and easily accessible in a more or less standardized format.
Gentleman on the left-hand side there, please. Can you have a mic over here? Two-thirds of the way down here. Thank you.
You raised the broader question of how we are going to allow third world countries to actually spend their money on combating AIDS. So how would you stop the West from attaching always conditions to eliminating debt? And that normally only means 80% of the debt. Conditions such as charging for healthcare. How would you get the trade rules changed, the subsidies removed from the West? All these kind of things which you were mentioning as the broader aspect, which was so very important, so they can have proper spending on these things. And I was also a bit worried about your confidence in the pharmaceutical industry, really. I was wondering whether or not it would be a better route to go down, having an independent pharmaceutical research and production facility, which would produce AIDS drugs under at cost price, as well as drugs for diseases which the pharmaceutical companies are not going to address. And this facility could come under the auspices of the WHO or the UN. Would this not be a better route to pursue rather than a one-off for AIDS, which may or may not actually work in the long run?
And the last question in this batch.
Chris Desmond here at LSC. Yeah, you spoke about how HIV/AIDS is an exceptional illness and how it requires an exceptional response. And you commented some on why that response has taken so long, the sexual nature of transmission, drugs involvement and such. But isn't it also that it's taken so long, not because it's exceptional, but because of it not being exceptional, that it's another crisis that occurs mainly in Africa, mainly in poor countries. And I'd like to know, what is UNAIDS's role in taking countries to task in their prejudices when they're considering their responses to a crisis such as this?
And we'll try and fit in another short batch of questions after this set of answers.
Well, maybe a few, yes.
Very short.
Very short, yeah.
Get value for money here, you know.
You economists.
No, it's DFID, you see. DFID insists on value for money.
Rightly so.
I see them all nodding.
Rightly so. Now, first, on the how to convince global leaders. I mean, it's because we're not there yet. I mean, to ask your question, that to respond to your question from Christian Aid. I think we've seen a major change. And then when I start saying that, I feel that I'm getting old. But when I started with UNAIDS, who would I see when I would go in a country? A minister of health who usually would say, oh, you know, well, yes, this AIDS thing, but, you know, we have a few cases, but we've got so many other things. And then they would start talking about malaria and so on, which is, of course, important, but all part of a denial, and that was it, and or blaming foreigners or someone coming from outside. Today, it is really in the speeches. It's a
you have these, we have that in the UN as well, you have all these long lists of things and problems and that, and now no list is complete without AIDS of all the misery in the world, it's in there. But so my cynical half thinks sometimes, oh, it's become fashionable. But we are not there yet in terms of action. This is why I believe that 2005 is going to be so important, not only for AIDS, but as I mentioned, for development. And this is why I have, I have great hopes. I'm not naive, but great hopes in the leadership of this government in doing this. And what would convince, what convinces leaders? On the one hand, can be personally being affected. That has happened in the very affected countries, definitely. Two, I would say peer pressure. L2L, leaders to leaders, works much better than UN to leaders, or, you know, it's bishops to bishops, business to business. And that means that you need a few champions, sometimes one champion among, you know, a prime minister who then talks to his or her peers. And that's where, you know, I wonder often, what are these regional meetings or summits, what are they good for, besides the blah blah and so on? Is there something coming out? And I think the answer is yes, because it is, and that, and the most significant, to say dynamic, to use that term, is peer pressure. You don't want to look bad with your colleagues in when you're all, you know, with the cameras of all the world there, and the Sherpas will make sure that their boss is not looking bad. And I think that's, and that's where, and how to create that peer pressure besides having a champion, that's where activism comes in. I mean, this is, was my first point. You know, you have this kind of interesting mix, but activism doesn't take everywhere. You need at least democracy. I mean, what happened in South Africa with the treatment action campaign, and who also used the legal system, would not be possible in many African or other countries, because there is no rule of law, or there isn't that kind of system, that fundamentally a democratic system. People sometimes forget that. I think that it also is to position AIDS as where it is. One of the reasons I, you know, I thought a lot about this, whether AIDS is exceptional or not, not to justify my existence, but it's really to see, is it really necessary to have an organization like UNAIDS? Is it necessary to have something like the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria? Is it necessary to have these exceptions on trade rules? And do we really need to question a lot of things because of AIDS? And so repositioning it, I think, and the security elements are, can help and so on. On the one size fits all, I agree that that's the first thing I did, and was a big difference when we started with UNAIDS as compared to the global program on AIDS, was that of WHO, as I said, we need planning and priority setting that starts in the countries, and not one form that you fill in whether you're in China or in Uganda or in Nicaragua. And in terms of the governance, because you're talking about governance of the AIDS response in a country, the basic principles are the same. I really believe it. If it's not dealt with at a level of prime minister or president, where will the budget come from? Who will take the courageous decisions that have to go against public opinion? That means, for example, if in Thailand the prime minister would not have taken this on, Prime Minister Anand, the same one who chaired, by the way, the high-level panel on new threats to security, and say, for example, all TV stations, all radio stations, need to air AIDS messages every day, so many minutes, prime time, etc. A minister of health, who by in most developing countries is not the top politician. In our countries, the health ministers often have the largest budget. In developing countries, they are, you look just at the list of protocol, they are somewhere down. Even education is higher up in the protocol line. And I think it's not fair to say that it's World Bank imposed. The bank has, in the MAP program, has always insisted that there is a clear authority that's coordinating, that is responsible for policy, and that has authority across sectors, and that is accountable. And I think these are sound principles. We fully agree with that. The problem is that we have now countries where you have several coordinating mechanisms. You have even Uganda, which has a was the first to have a national AIDS committee. The Uganda AIDS Commission went through different phases and so on. Every time it had an evaluation, and that some people suggested put it in the Ministry of Health, the conclusion was always keep it in the office of the president. And but there you have that with proven track record, etc. You have now the CCM, the country coordinating mechanism of the for the Global Fund. There is the World Bank has supported and has used the existing mechanism. Global Fund created one. Coming back to the American question, PEPFAR is using the Uganda AIDS Commission, has a separate advisory council or something like that, but is using the mechanism. I think that we have to look at the alternative. We also have to understand what do we mean by evidence, again. You can't do a controlled clinical trial to demonstrate that that would work, but it makes perfect sense politically. And when you look at the alternatives, wherever a minister of health is in charge, it's a disaster. AIDS is not taken seriously. And we have to distinguish between implementation. This is where ministries of health come in, the line ministries. There's no doubt about that. But when it comes to the policy setting, coordination, resource mobilization, monitoring, evaluation, and the politics, you need them. Antiretrovirals, great hope. Is it possible? Are we going for a disaster? This is an area where the only way to know all this is to do it. Theoretically, there is an enormous risk for widespread antiretroviral resistance, and that's the reason why rolling out these programs has to be done really carefully, that they have to be done with drugs that are of good quality, people that we pay attention to treatment adherence and so on, and that we monitor all that. But I think that today saying that we need enough evidence, I don't know how we would collect the evidence without doing it, and denying businesses and entire sectors from preserving capacity, just looking at that, I think it's just not an option. Will 3x5 be achieved by the end of the year? I don't know. What I know is that what we announced jointly was with the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, so the Americans, Global Fund, World Bank, WHO, and UNAIDS. We brought this everybody together so that we would monitor how many people are on the treatment. Now 750,000 by the end of last year, coming from about 300,000 at the beginning of the year. So there is definitely an acceleration going on. And I'm sure, I'm confident at the end of the year there will be millions, but 3 million, I don't know. It will require a major, effort. What I believe in, though, is that last year there was a lot of investments were made in training, developing drug procurement systems and so on, and that should pay off this year. What is predictable, I think, is that the services that can provide this treatment will be saturated at some point. Is that at 3 million or 2 million or 4 million? I have no clue. But increasing access to treatment after that saturation, particularly in cities, has happened, that is going to be extremely difficult. And so that we need to plan for that. And main stumbling blocks, well, I mentioned some of them. Some is capacity, but it can be procurement. It is not very sexy. This is not something that will get to the front pages. It's really good management. It is accountability. It's that kind of things that but I think also not using the right approaches. That's why I mentioned so much in my capacity part of the speech, community capacity. That is, it's not going to work with just a few doctors and clinics. I have to go faster now. This, how to capture knowledge at the micro level, I think that's an extremely important question. And it has not really been done enough. That has to be done locally. We've tried to do this with UNAIDS in what we call our best practice series, but it's we now realize that it's just not possible. We have to support this kind of exercises far more in individual countries. And in some big countries like India, one has to do it at the state level. Because when you get into the micro practice of development, then it's very important to have the local conditions and environment. How to stop the West change the rules and so on, and of conditionality. I think there has been already a big change in donor behavior. Many donors have now abandoned tied aid. I mean, in other words, that you can only get our pounds or dollars or francs if you have our experts and so on. I mean, that's a big change from, what, 5 years or for how long? Even 5 years ago. We're not there yet with everybody. How to, the conditionalities of the debt, of debt relief and debt cancellation. Frankly, I think there should be some conditionalities there to make sure that that is not used, the money that's freed up for, that's the simplest thing is that to buy arms and so on. I mean, we have to, there needs to be some reward for good behavior and that's it. Am I overconfident in pharmaceutical industry? Definitely not. I've had a lot to do with. But also, I think that it's without pharmaceutical industry, we cannot do it. It's just impossible. And an independent facility for production, I think that is, I mean, that is something that now several countries are setting up. Brazil has done that. Facilities for the development of drugs, well, we see actually a trend that goes totally in the opposite. And in the case of AIDS, there is a clear market incentive, fortunately, to be a bit ironic or cynical, is that there are people living with HIV in wealthy countries. It's a big market. Without that, we wouldn't have had any antiretrovirals, probably. Then it would have been just as for neglected diseases. But there is a clear market incentive to develop new antiretrovirals for selling in the US and in Western Europe. There are, after all, we're talking about a market of well over 1 million people and a stable market, because once you put someone on treatment, it's for life. So there will be a need for, the clientele is clear, the marketing plans that, so that's very, and then lastly, yeah, I've said some in the speech and was not taken well often, but that if this epidemic would have affected white people in the first place and not been a problem in Africa, I'm sure we would have, if this would have been in the Balkans or so, we would have probably have a far more vigorous response. But I mean, there's no evidence for that, what I'm saying, if you look at that. And what have we been doing, but now I forgot, what has UNAIDS been doing for, I can't remember the last question.
Is the last questioner still here?
No. Well.
Right. In that case, I'm going to declare that we have had value for money. And thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
That was tremendous. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We must do it.
Yeah.